Hello and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. On today's episode, we'll be reviewing the latest Bitcoin news from January 2024. So obviously the biggest news of the month is the Bitcoin ETF. We'll be discussing that and a few other items. So my name is Daniel. I'm the founder of Hardblock. And we also have Alex joining me, who also works together with me at Hardblock. How are you, Alex?
Yeah, hi, Dan. Hi, everyone. Yeah, great to be back again for another news recap.
So I remember last episode, we forgot something which a lot of people find interesting, just talking about the price.
Yeah, what was that?
Well, we didn't talk about the price. We skipped the price talk last time, but I thought maybe we'd just do a quick summary of the price this time. Obviously, for the month, Bitcoin started at Australian $62,000 on 1st of January. So $62,000. Then it started going up, trending upwards, and went to 72,000 Australian on 12th of January. That was right before the ETF announcement. So in the lead up to the ETF announcement, it was going up. And then I think maybe to the surprise of a few people, when the ETF actually did get announced, the price dropped back down and it's around $65,000 now. So this is like 31st of January. And we actually saw that also at Hardblock, didn't we? Like, we saw like quite a lot of volume in the lead up to the ETF, and our volume dropped off quite a bit after the ETF got announced.
Yeah, it's gone a bit quiet, which is maybe some expected it. I suspect a lot of people didn't expect that. Well, I remember earlier in the month, well, firstly, it was the fumble from the SEC where their Twitter account got hacked. They published, well, hacked, in quotes, hacked. What was it really? We're not really sure. Maybe they just published a tweet that they weren't meant to early. But yeah, I was up listening to it, watching the price rise, getting excited. And then it started going back down. It was time for bed.
So it's like, we talk about in trading, there's this like very old saying, buy the rumor, sell the news. And it's actually something that happens quite a lot, which is like when there's an expectation of something happening, like it causes like buy when before the actual event happens. So buy the rumor when something's about to happen, start buying then. And then when the actual event occurs, sell and take profit. So I think there was a lot of that. People could see that the ETF was going to get approved and they started buying up and sold some Bitcoin to take profit. Or to me, I think you should be taking profit in Bitcoin. But anyway, that's a different matter. It dropped down, but it's kind of steady now. And I think, you know, soon we have a halving in a few months, and it's probably going to be another. I wouldn't be surprised if it'd be another type of thing, like where, you know, buy the rumor and sell the news, where people, it's going to be going up before the halving, and then when it actually happens, it might drop down a bit. So we'll see if the same thing occurs then. But since we're talking about the ETF, obviously that's the big news of the month. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, it's obviously huge news. We had the huge news in December with the FASB accounting change. And then this month, we've just had the ETFs. I really liked James Check from Glassnode. He really summarized it, I think, really well, which is it's the end of the beginning. Like, it's a new phase for Bitcoin. We're becoming much larger. It's just a necessary step that we start to incorporate a lot more of mainstream finance. And with that, it's going to come, you know, some downsides, which is a lot of centralized custodianship of large pools of Bitcoin, but also a lot of opportunities in terms of onboarding a whole bunch of new users.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It does feel that way to me also. With these ETFs, so what actually happened, there were a few ETFs got approved. I think like 7 or 8 of them.
11. 11 ETFs.
Was it 11 ETFs? So yeah. I guess because if they approved one, they had to approve all of them. So 11 ETFs got approved, and obviously, the most leading one was by BlackRock, which is like a huge company. And it's like a company very close to the US establishment. I think now they're like working with the US government. They committed money to help rebuild Ukraine. So they're kind of like a very establishment company connected. So that's why people thought if BlackRock is applying, it's going to get approved, and did get approved. To me, definitely, it does feel like the start of a different era in Bitcoin. And I remember, like, this talk about ETFs, it's been happening for so long now. I remember back around 2016 or 2017, I was in Bali I went to Bali for a few months, and there was a Bitcoin meetup there. And I remember that meetup, it was shortly after the Winklevoss twins announced that they were trying to get an ETF approved. And at that, so in that Bitcoin meetup in 2016, like people, that's what people were talking about. Oh, you know, ETF is about to come. ETF is about to come. The Winklevoss applied for ETFs. ETF is coming. And that was 2016, and it never came. It was always coming, and there's going to be a Bitcoin ETF, like a spot Bitcoin ETF. It was always going to come, and never came until, you know, this month when it did actually happen. And yeah, it definitely feels like a different era. Like, I don't know, there's going to be some ups, positive sides to that and negative sides. We can discuss that. But yeah. It does feel like, you know, we'll see what it's like, going to be a different time for Bitcoin. Yeah. So I've got some other information about like the ETFs. So reasonably popular already, even though it's only a few weeks of trading. So apparently this is what I read on Bitcoin News, and that the Bitcoin ETF, the volume has already surpassed silver. So Bitcoin surpasses silver to become second largest ETF commodity in the US. Yeah, I'm guessing like gold ETFs are number one. It didn't mention it, but it must be gold as number one. So Bitcoin is now the second biggest ETF commodity. So it's already like after the first few weeks, it's already gaining popularity.
I think I read another great stat as well, which was the volume of the Bitcoin ETFs alone exceeded all the volume of all other ETFs that were launched last year.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
every year, obviously, they're launching a whole bunch of new ETFs, you know, like let's have a, you know, just a new financial scam, really. The Bitcoin ETFs have exceeded the volume of all other ETFs combined that were launched last year.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's like I'm looking at the volume, but they have like volume of around 11 day volume of around Grayscale has like 12 billion, BlackRock, 5 billion. So that's kind of around the volume. And yeah, there will be a lot of money coming in because so the big thing about the ETF is, you know, people like individuals like us and like our customers, we help customers buy Bitcoin, but a lot of big money out there, it's not really easy. We're not used to investing Bitcoin the way we do it, holding it. And often we're not allowed to because of these various complicated regulations. So if this is money like pension funds, endowment, like asset managers, like in Australia, a lot of them can't even buy Bitcoin because it's like if it's a financial manager, there's a regulated items where they can invest in. So they're not even allowed to buy Bitcoin. But so a lot of these fund managers and asset managers in the US now will be able to get exposure to Bitcoin because while they can't buy Bitcoin directly, they can buy it through an ETF. So there's a huge, really wave of money that will be now able to access Bitcoin. So at least in the short term, over the next year, you can't see how that is not bullish for the Bitcoin price. So that's, and I think it's a good thing overall that people who, you know, more people will be able to have exposure to Bitcoin, which is what I consider the best money in the world. So I think that's a good thing. But yeah, do you agree with that? Like, and I guess do you think this is a positive thing or a negative thing for Bitcoin?
Oh, I definitely think it's a positive thing. Something that really sort of stands out now is it's really going to be a slow burn. So a lot of those money managers, you know, the pension funds, asset managers, like you talked about, they're still not on board with Bitcoin. Yes, they have now been given the rails to get entry when they want it, but they still need to want it to get on board. And I think for many of them, it's going to be that slow burn as they come around over time. So what we've done is we've unlocked with the ETFs, we've unlocked the pools of capital, but the pools of capital aren't here yet. So I think, and this ties into why it's maybe a buy the rumor, sell the news event, though I think you'd be silly to be selling right now. Is the reason it's a buy, we've had this sort of sideways action is because all we've done is unlocked it. And the capital is yet to flow in, and we're going to expect it to flow in over the next months and years, not the next days and weeks.
Yeah, I agree. So it was like immediately after the event, like it went down a little bit. But yeah, over the next few months, there'll be more and more coming in, and that's going to put upwards pressure on the Bitcoin price, almost certainly.
The other thing that's pretty interesting in terms of the whole price action around the ETF at the moment is that a lot of the volume that we're seeing immediately is transfers out of the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. And so before the ETF, the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust was one of the main ways that large players were holding Bitcoin and getting exposure to Bitcoin price. Grayscale Bitcoin Trust was heavily involved with the Genesis disaster, Genesis Trading, and FTX was holding a lot of GBTC as well. And so we're still seeing the fallout and hangover from all of those collapses and insolvencies from 2022. And those entities, with the launches of the ETFs, are finally able to sell that GBTC. And so we're seeing a lot of outflows at the same time as the massive inflows. And so that's having a real neutralizing effect on the price action right now.
Yeah, right. So because that Grayscale Trust, I don't know that much about it. Maybe you know more. But from what I understand, so that wasn't like an ETF, but it was just like a trust. And
yeah,
put into the trust, but it wasn't like an ETF. It was just traded and anybody could invest in it. Is that correct?
Well, I might have to check. Yeah, I won't say that. Yeah. I don't know exactly how it was available.
Like it was a way to get exposure, but it was a bit more complicated. But now it's just like a ETF. So anybody really, I'm guessing it's listed on like any stock broker. If you have a share account, anybody can just access and buy it, and it's much more accessible. You know, I'm not an expert in this stuff, but
they had huge pools of Bitcoin. And so we're starting to see that flow out because they charge such high fees. The way that the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust was set up, it was very expensive. It didn't quite have the same regulatory framework around it as the ETF. So even now that it's being converted to an ETF, there's a lot of people that are deciding, hey, I've had enough of Grayscale and I want to move into something else like a BlackRock or Fidelity.
So it wasn't a spot ETF. It was a trust. So yeah, I think Grayscale sort of the price updated just like once per day or something like that. And basically you put money into the trust and the trust held Bitcoin. But anyway, another thing, like in terms of the negative, and why overall I think it's a positive thing, but kind of what you were saying before, I feel a lot of people who kind of don't really understand what Bitcoin is, and they don't really understand that, okay, you can buy Bitcoin for an ETF, but it's not really proper Bitcoin.
It's an IOU for Bitcoin.
It's an IOU. So you're not really owning Bitcoin. You're owning a pipe, a climb to somebody who owns Bitcoin on your behalf. That's kind of really how to look at it. And so the people who own Bitcoin ETFs, I've seen it described as like you a second class citizen in Bitcoin, which is, I agree with that. And I think a lot of those people don't even realize, because they don't understand Bitcoin, they wouldn't realize that they would be second class citizens of Bitcoin. And the reason they're second class citizen is like Bitcoin, a lot of the magical properties of Bitcoin is that it's a bearer asset. That means you're actually controlling the asset. There's no counterparty. Obviously, there is a counterparty. You're relying on BlackRock or ETFs to hold it for you. You're relying on them. And you can't just send Bitcoin anywhere you want, whatever. Like, you're not really owning it. You're not really owning the Bitcoin. They're owning it for you. So all these properties of being able to send a bearer asset across the world instantly, sending to whoever you want permissionless money, none of this applies to you if you're holding Bitcoin as a second class citizen in an ETF.
Yep, absolutely right. Yep. Yeah. One positive thing out of the ETFs, I guess, the whole thing's positive, but one little, I guess, cherry on top is that a couple of the ETFs have pledged money towards open source development. So I think it's VanEck has published they announced they're going to donate 5% of their profits from their Bitcoin ETF, one of the ETF providers, to Bitcoin Core development. And then it's Bitwise, I believe, is the other ETF provider that pledged 10% which is going to be split three ways between OpenSats, Brink, and the Human Rights Foundation Bitcoin Development Fund, which are all organizations that sort of provide funding to Bitcoin developers and open source development more generally.
Yeah, that's cool. And do you know Bitwise, do you know like who controls, who owns that ETF, who's behind it?
Well, no, I have no idea. It's Bitwise. Not a...
Okay. No, I just asked because I will have to look it up. But so Bitwise also, from these ETFs, they announced that they will be, like they actually released the addresses behind the ETF. So, you know, that's kind of a cool thing that you can do with Bitcoin. So you can actually see how much Bitcoin they hold, because you can look at the on-chain holdings, and Bitwise has released their addresses, and people can just, or basically anybody can audit the ETF and make sure that they have the Bitcoin that they say they do, which is a very cool thing that Bitcoin allows that you can't do with something like gold or silver ETFs.
Yep. I'm just having a look at Bitwise right now. Yeah, I don't see anything about them. Like, they just seem like a company. They're looking, you know, they're not just Bitcoin, as any of the ETF providers seem to be. Maybe Fidelity understands Bitcoin the most. But yeah, that looks like they're right into Web3 and crypto. So yeah. It's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah. And the reason I ask why, like, who's behind them is because, you know, I'm kind of like a bit, maybe can be a bit cynical and conspiracy minded, like Bitcoin people. A lot of Bitcoin people are, and we have a lot of like some suspicion of some of these people, and like it's good that we're funding Bitcoin development and stuff, but I just want to make sure like who's behind it, because it, like when you it is like it is a different, like we said, it is a different era in Bitcoin, and when there's all this extra money coming in, and if we're going to be funding Bitcoin development, like what influence that will have, and would things like privacy, would they have the same kind of, you know, what will they be funding it? Like if they're funding Bitcoin development, you know, maybe they can have some influence on the direction. So it's just something like, you know, to be cautious of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think at least for Bitwise, they're donating, well, they're intending to donate through through those three organizations, so OpenSats, Brink, and the Human Rights Foundation Development Fund. So I think they'll at least direct influence will be somewhat limited, but you know, that's just the way the world works. Like where there's wealth and power, there's always influence.
Yeah, and just one other thing I wanted to say about like regarding the like the ETFs and like holding it as a second class citizen. You know, I've been reading the book by Lynn Oden, Broken Money, and I was reading the history about the section about the history of money, and in it she talks about, you know, that kind of progress. And so obviously initially people had gold, and they were using gold and money. Then there was like coinage, and they thought, okay, well, you know, if people have gold, they'll store it at some kind of institution. So if they put the gold in some kind of bank-like institution, which held it on their behalf, and they thought, well, instead of like transacting it between ourselves, we can just have like paper IOUs from the bank, and we'll transact the paper IOUs, which is like money. And so then most people didn't, you know, going into the 19th century, most people, even though it was the gold standard, most people didn't hold gold. They just held gold in a bank. And then what happened is, like, towards the end of the 19th century, government started introducing central banks. Because, okay, instead of having all this gold in individual banks, we don't have a central bank, which is going to hold all the gold, and the individual banks don't hold gold. And then they thought, well, all this gold is just sitting in a central bank. Why do we even need gold in the first place? And I guess what I'm saying is, basically, there was this progression from where people actually held gold as like a bearer asset. And then it was like the next step, well, we can have this a lot of convenience, to, for example, hold the gold in a bank. And then there's always like this next step of convenience. But what happens after many centuries is basically society became very divorced. Like there were many layers of separation from the gold, where towards the end of the gold standard, it was, okay, you held gold, well, you held money, which is backed by the gold standard, but you held money in your local bank, and the local bank didn't hold the gold. It was held on behalf of the local bank in a central bank. It was like these many degrees of separation between an individual and the gold that they owned. Mm-hmm. And reading that book, and it's kind of, I can't help but seeing the parallel, where it's almost like this kind of first step where, people have Bitcoin and they're holding it as a bearer asset. And now it's kind of going to custody. But is that kind of basically, is that layer of, but degrees of separation between people and their Bitcoin, is that going to increase? Anyway, we'll see. Like it's a different era, and we'll see how it evolves. But yeah, I just couldn't help noticing the parallels. Oh, does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, yeah, I just finished reading the book actually recently as well myself. Yeah,
it was a big book.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it's really interesting. I actually I started reading it and then I gave up and got the audiobook. I just seem to get through audiobooks much quicker. So, and then I gifted my physical copy to a friend. So let's see if that orange peels him.
Anyway, so I think we can move on. Are you happy? I think we've talked enough about ETFs. Do you have any other items?
About the ETFs? No.
Next news item.
Oh, next news item. There's a couple of just little ones that I thought were quite interesting, little announcements. So first was Mastering Bitcoin, which is the very well-known and widely read book on around the technical side of Bitcoin. So the third edition of Mastering Bitcoin was published in December last year. And just this week, it's been open sourced on GitHub. So anyone who hasn't read that book, who's maybe slightly technically minded, you don't need to be a coder, just interested in more how the technical side of Bitcoin actually functions. I highly recommend the book. It's a comprehensive and quite a deep dive on it, but it's well worth reading. And it's now available for free on GitHub if you just search Mastering Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's my favorite book about the technical aspect of Bitcoin. Yeah, I used it and helped me understand Bitcoin. And it's technical, like it's a good level. It's not, I wouldn't say it's simple. You need to be somewhat technically minded, but it's not like super complicated either. You don't need to be some crazy genius technical wizard to understand it. So it's kind of accessible. I really like it.
Yeah. And the third edition I'm about halfway through at the moment. It's brought a lot of changes and updates, which I think are significant improvement. So even if you've read it previously and maybe you're interested in refreshing, it's worth checking out this third edition. Brings us up to date with things like Taproot.
Okay, so I'll go to the next item. So Bitcoin adoption in Pakistan continues to rise without regulatory clarity. So this is an article by on Bitcoin Magazine. I found it interesting. Basically, to summarize the article, it talks about Bitcoin in Pakistan and how recently there was like a local meetup launched in Pakistan, which makes me kind of think like, you know, that's the first local meetup in Pakistan. It shows me how much like more adoption there is to go. But anyway, the premise of the article is even though Bitcoin is not illegal in Pakistan, it's kind of discouraged by the authorities and by the central government. And so there's no actual exchanges there for the locals to use. But despite that, Bitcoin adoption has been growing quite a lot. And people just buy, and mostly the people use like peer-to-peer services like Binance, Paxful, and other kind of methods to buy Bitcoin. So it's interesting because it shows even without kind of exchanges and like centralized exchanges, Bitcoin can still thrive in this kind of environment through peer-to-peer methods. And that's, you know, when the centralized exchanges, you know, people don't really use P2P, but if they go away for whatever reason, people can still buy Bitcoin. And that's probably also, the article talks about the situation in Pakistan. So one of the reasons is the bad economic situation. So it has inflation, yearly inflation exceeding 25% per year. So, you know, people want things like Bitcoin to save their money. And also there's a lot of people using it. People who are employed by companies overseas.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the interesting points of the article, is that a huge percentage of the working population in Pakistan is employed in the IT sector, and specifically offering IT services globally. And so I think that's got to have, you know, that's got to be a bit of a driver here, because firstly, they're a lot more on the technical side, so they're going to be exposed to Bitcoin and probably have a little bit more confidence in diving in and trying to understand what it is. And then secondly, they can earn Bitcoin. So it's a in a country that doesn't necessarily endorse Bitcoin, it's an easy way for the Bitcoin to make its way through into the country. It's like a route for capital flowing. Next news item, another good one, is Fendimint. So Fendimint, which we've all heard about previously, is a way of doing federated custody of Bitcoin, and specifically using Champion eCash, which brings a whole bunch of privacy improvements and integrates really well into Lightning. They've had their launch of version 0.2.1, which is, you know, what does that mean? The exciting news is that it's their first stable MVP, so minimum viable product, release, which means that from here on in, they'll be looking to only make backwards compatible changes. So it's not the first release of Fendimint, but it's a big step towards it, and it gives people who are building, who are maybe looking to build services or things on top of Fendimint, it gives them the confidence to start investing time and serious effort towards it, because they know that there's not going to be major changes going forwards, which is really exciting. We've heard a lot about Fendimints. We know it's potentially a big game changer in distributing custody and making custody a lot more accessible for people that aren't necessarily as savvy at holding their own keys. Yeah, it's very exciting to see this release. It also means that if you want to, you can now go and run your own federation and stand up as a guardian and start to experiment if you like.
Yeah, but so is it open for use by the public right now?
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see how much adoption it gets, because the kind of conceptually seems cool. So basically, it's where, like, it's semi self custody, and the idea is that you help people around you to custody their Bitcoin. Like, conceptually, that's what it is, as much as I understand. So yeah, the concept seems cool. So hopefully, it does gain adoption.
Yeah, I think it'll still take some time. This is not a 1.0 release or anything like that, but it's just a significant step that they've done the first release that's going to be stable. So up until now, every time they make a release, it creates a whole bunch of breaking changes. And so anyone who's trying to build or do anything with Fendimint, every time there's an update, it basically just, like, it breaks. They can't update without doing major changes to their own servers. So from now on, people have the confidence to build on it, and we'll start to see, I think, Fendimint things grow in the next months and years.
Yeah. So next news item, also from Bitcoin Magazine, Bitcoin adoption. Hong Kong is Asia's rising crypto hub. So, and the premise of this article was talking about how the government in Hong Kong is trying to encourage investment, not in cryptocurrency, but just more generally, but it's allowing more liberal rules regarding cryptocurrency, where it's going to allow licensed exchanges, and it's going to allow for people to, like, for Hong Kongese people to buy Bitcoin and hold it legally through those licensed exchanges. And for me, that's kind of interesting, because I view that as a possible sign of where China is going, because obviously Hong Kong is ultimately under Chinese jurisdiction. So it's interesting that Hong Kong, why like Bitcoin is restricted in China, in the mainland. It's interesting that they're allowing, they're opening up and allowing Bitcoin and cryptocurrency more generally in Hong Kong, because it could be a possible sign of what's to happen in China. Because I think the way, like historically, the way the Chinese government does things is, you know, they often allow these kind of experiments in places like Hong Kong, and it would be kind of like filling the waters with allow, because ultimately we know that Hong Kong has to listen to what the Chinese authorities do. So China was completely against Bitcoin, they wouldn't allow it in Hong Kong. But since it's like being allowed in Hong Kong, I wonder if that is a sign we're allowing it as a kind of experimentation with the possibility of maybe allowing it more in the Chinese mainland in the future, where we don't want to kind of completely cut themselves off from Bitcoin and this technology. That's kind of my read on it. And what's your take, Alex?
Yeah, I don't know. I did read through the article. I honestly don't know a lot about Hong Kong. Obviously, the dynamic and situation in Hong Kong has changed radically in the last few years, immediately prior to COVID with the protests. So it's definitely under a lot more strict Chinese control than it ever was. So yeah, I think I agree. It is a good sign. In fact, I think any jurisdiction that's not aligned with the United States adopting Bitcoin, making Bitcoin easier, making space for Bitcoin companies to operate, even if it's just under the wider umbrella of crypto and Web3 scams, I think that's a really good sign, and it really adds to Bitcoin's resilience. Got another news article, which is the launch of Aqua Wallet. But one thing that I thought was really interesting about this is Aqua Wallet is a wallet that's launched with, so it's a Bitcoin on-chain wallet. It also has Bitcoin Lightning integrated, but also the Liquid Network, which is a federated blockchain that's run by Blockstream, which is one of the more OG Bitcoin companies. And then also on top of that, it has support for Tether, which is the US dollar stablecoin. And they've got support for that on Liquid, being run US dollar Tether on Liquid. And then also, I think, potentially Ethereum and Tron. And I think I just think this wallet's really interesting because this is sort of what a lot of people have been talking about for the last few years in terms of the sort of tools that are necessary, especially in emerging markets where people potentially can't tolerate the volatility of Bitcoin with all of their wealth, right? So if you've only got a small amount of wealth and you're living sort of day to day, week to week, you cannot tolerate a 50 or 80% drop in value. So having access to stablecoins, easy access to stablecoins, is really, it's a necessity. If you're in a country going through hyperinflation and you're just not in a position where you can make the full jump to Bitcoin, being able to access a stablecoin is very significant improvement over just having part of your wealth in Bitcoin and part of your wealth in the hyperinflating home currency. So I think it's good. So a lot of people have said this is sort of ideally what they'd like to see in a day-to-day spending wallet. And I think it'll be interesting to see how much adoption this sort of model of a wallet gets going forwards.
Did you say it's released by Blockstream?
No. I was saying Liquid. The Liquid network is run by Blockstream, but the wallet itself is it's associated with Samson Mao, and he's got his company Jan3. I don't know if the company actually owns Aqua Wallet, or he's definitely. Oh yeah, it is Jan3. So it's Jan3, which is Samson Mao's sort of initiative, just for spreading Bitcoin adoption.
It's supposed to be like a, in terms of security, like a light, easy to use wallet for small amounts.
Yeah. So it's a mobile
like
wallet.
Seen like this,
it's like a mobile day to day spending wallet. And it's the reason it's interesting is it has these integrations with Lightning and Liquid and Tether as well. So it's all in one place. Just looks like it's sort of what a lot of people have been asking for a while.
Yeah, okay. So like one of Samson Mao's things these days is he's trying to get more nation states to adopt Bitcoin the way El Salvador has. And one of the things that came out of from El Salvador is when we kind of adopted Bitcoin legal tender was that wasn't really a good maybe wallet for people to use there. So maybe it seems to me like Samson Mao is kind of trying to make a wallet for these kind of countries in developing world, an easy to use wallet.
Yeah, well, in El Salvador, the Chivo wallet launch was riddled with technical problems and difficulties. So yeah, I think having a wallet like this, which is easily available, and as these other countries start to look towards Bitcoin, or even just where they don't, such as maybe say in Argentina, where they're not going to maybe specifically endorse Bitcoin and roll out a national wallet, like having these tools available for people that can't necessarily operate 100% on Bitcoin is I think very important.
That's what I was trying to say. The Chibo wallet that they mined in El Salvador, yeah, it had so many, it seems to have many issues and been a bit of a failure, to be honest. So I guess he's trying to make it so it's like, next time we're here, you don't have to make Chibo wallet, you can just maybe rebrand this as your own national wallet.
Well, Aqua wallet's been open sourced. It took a couple of weeks after the launch for them to open source it. They're saying they're just busy, but it's now open sourced. So yeah, it would be quite simple for someone to just port it and rebrand, which is, it's great to have something like that available.
Okay. So the next news item I have is, I'll read the headline, is 26 plus Bitcoin companies sign a letter to FinCEN against proposed surveillance rules. So FinCEN in the United States is an authority that regulates financial companies, and they proposed some kind of surveillance rules. I don't know the details. I didn't read the proposal, but more or less it was outlawing any sort of coin joins or coin mixing. And like, if you do any of that, you are criminal and you're not allowed to do any of that or participate in it. So a lot of Bitcoin companies, and this is like large Bitcoin companies, Coinbase, everybody I believe signed it. Like criticizing that proposal, saying that, you know, people sometimes need this kind of coin mixing for legitimate reasons, and there's a legitimate right to privacy, and there's legitimate like security use, but people need to use some of these coin joins, and that they shouldn't be kind of forbidden. So we'll see how that goes. Because, yeah, I mean, like, you can't just ban mixing and things like that. You just can't outright ban it.
Yeah, well, I think they'll try. And that's what this letter is really pushing back against, is overly broad definitions, contradictory definitions, which, as we know, is just the de facto standard for all things government and regulation. But, yeah, it's specifically pushing back on some of the most egregious stuff around definitions which conflict and definitions which are overly wide. And I've had a read through the letter this morning. It's a bit of legalese, which is, you know, it's hard first thing in the morning, but it's quite interesting. And I really, this is not going to move the needle. This letter is not going to move the needle, but it's an important thing to be able to point to, I think, if you're trying to take a stand, and then as it works its way through the courts and the regulatory process, to at least say, hey, we raised these things at some point.
Yeah. And it's good for those companies that doing something, pushing back. And like we said earlier, like, kind of money is influence and power. And at the end of the day, some of these companies, like, you know, they're becoming bigger and bigger, and Bitcoin is becoming bigger and bigger, and with that comes more influence. So hopefully they'll be able to kind of have a positive influence on these regulators and politicians, because you can't just ban Bitcoin mixing. It's crazy. Like, I don't know, how are you gonna, it's hard to enforce. And there's legitimate reasons to do it.
Got one more news item, which is so Swan Bitcoin's launched their Swan Mining, or they've announced their Swan Mining initiative, And crazily, they've already supposedly got around 4.5 exahash, which is around 1% of the whole Bitcoin mining network, which is just a phenomenal amount of hash power. I think the reason this is interesting, I mean, other than the fact that they now control a not insignificant part of the network, is I guess earlier in the month, there was some criticism of Swan because they published another announcement basically claiming that they'd spent a huge amount of money in the space in terms of VC funding with their VC initiative. And there were a lot of questions raised because people were looking at that announcement and thinking things hadn't added up. Matadel was sort of like one of the ones leading the charge on that. And so I guess this has triggered a bit of transparency from Swan, and they've sort of made the announcement that that huge amount of funding they claim to have deployed into the Bitcoin ecosystem has actually was real, and that it was mostly mining related.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, they seem like a good company, so good on them, and over best of luck. So I don't have any more news, so I think we can finish for today. If you're happy, Alex, yeah. you have nothing. So yeah, I hope you at home enjoyed that, and give us some feedback, what you liked and you didn't. And see you next time.
All right, talk to you later.